If you will, turn in your Old Testaments to the book of Ecclesiastes. And, of course, we want to offer up to anyone who is comfortable with that and desire to do that, comments that you want to add to the material that we're talking about. Any questions you might have, certainly. Please feel free to speak up. Just have a kind of a class atmosphere here. So I want to start off just... What I'm going to try to do is to cover the material that's in the book. If you'll read it before the class starts, that will be helpful. And, of course, the discussion questions, if you'll kind of write down some things about the discussion questions, those are found on page 5, discussion questions producing additional insight. And we'll take the time at the end of the class to look at those things at the end of this each lesson. But I'm not going to try to go reading through it verbatim and just cover the main points that are found here. So the first thing I want to talk about is the point of view of the book. The book of Ecclesiastes is a very peculiar book in that the primary theme of the book is one that's not valid. And it's a literary device that the wise man of the book uses to indicate a resounding truth that he concludes his book with. And there are things sprinkled throughout the book to indicate that this is merely a device. But as you know, Solomon, which I believe to be the one who wrote the book, we'll talk about that in a few moments, is an individual who gained a great deal of wisdom given to him by God as a result of his petition to assist him in his rule as king over Israel. But you also know that Solomon kind of went off the deep end with regard to his life and his pursuit of other things. And so this book basically is a book that is written to explain what he learned in his life in the pursuit of pleasure and other things. And so when you look at the book, in chapter 1 and verse 1, you'll notice there, it's the words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanity, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Well, that is a phrase that is used a number of times in the book. He actually begins the book with that phrase. He ends the book with that phrase, Ecclesiastes 12:1. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. And that's not true. If you think about that, our life here on this earth, everything about it is vain. That's not actually a valid statement. But if you understand the device, the methodology he's using, he's basically saying, I lived a portion of my life without a concern for God. My focus was on getting what I could out of life without God in the picture. And what I've come to conclude in this is that by living my life that way, that I've lived a vain life. And that's a valid point. And so this is simply, again, kind of a literary device where he's speaking in the present, referring to how he felt in the past. And then at the end of the book, kind of going to the end from the beginning, just to turn, if you will, to Ecclesiastes chapter 12. And I want you to notice, starting with verse 11, he says, the words of the wise are like goads, and the words of scholars are like well-driven nails given by one shepherd. Further, my son, be admonished by these. Of making many books there is no end, and much study is wearisome to the flesh. Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God, keep his commandments, for this is man's all. For God will bring every work into judgment, including every secret thing, whether good or evil. Now that is the whole point of the book. He goes through the entirety of the book explaining why this truth is true. But that's the conclusion. So he's saying life is vain unless life is lived for God. Because that's the reason we're here. Now, we could say, okay, that's it, and go on home. And we've got the basic premise of the book, but there are so many ways in which this is illustrated here in the text that it is very, very helpful. Because basically, men have not learned that. And even we as Christians, we struggle to understand and acknowledge that sometimes, because it is obvious that in our own lives we can get sidetracked, our focus and priorities can become skewed to where, although we may acknowledge and may realize that serving God is what it's all about while we're here, because of the mundane things of life and because of the lust of the flesh and the lust of the eyes and the pride of life, we can get caught up in things that are less important, things that ultimately have no value or substance, instead of understanding what is important. And so by illustrating the things that he tried and he found no value in, then we can say, oh, you know, I've done that as well, or I have that same problem, and I've got to think in the same way. And so I think it's a very good study, and it's one of my favorite studies. In fact, typically when I hold a gospel meeting on Sunday morning, you know, I've thrown away a lot of my sermons that I've used in the past in gospel meetings and replaced them with others. But almost always, for the past 10 years or so, Sunday morning is reserved for a study of Ecclesiastes. And basically what I'm going to do, or what I did doing my sermon on and during the gospel meeting week, is point B on under number 1 on page 2, the 11 vanities that left him empty. That's kind of what I talk about. It's just a survey of the book, and you go over these, and it's very, very helpful. I want to do that as well in our study this morning. Okay, so looking at then the first page of chapter 1, we're talking again about this concept of vanity, and I just wanted to note what that meant. I like the way he put it at the end of the first paragraph, is that this is a repeated sigh. And I want you to think about that, because really the primary voice that you receive in this text is one of despair. I tried this, it just didn't work. I tried that, there wasn't anything for me there either. And you know, it's an experiential type of an approach to life. The way in which I can figure out is by trying it all, which, by the way, has its own problems. You know, there's a lot of destruction that comes with making wrong choices. And the best way to learn is by learning from the mistakes that other people make rather than your own mistakes. That's something we need to teach our kids and emphasize to that. Yes, they have done it, and they regret having done it, so why don't you listen to their regrets and avoid doing it yourself? Again, it's a hard lesson for us to learn. We all do make mistakes, but we can certainly learn from his mistakes. So this is a despairing sigh. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Does anyone have an idea as to what the word vanity means specifically? I mean, I've made some allusion already. Anybody want to try to define that or talk about that a little bit?
Emptiness.
Okay. Concept of emptiness. Something that is lacking in substance.
No worth.
Okay. I want you to think about it in pictures. There's a passage, I believe it's chapter 1 and verse 14. Chapter 1 and verse 14, where he talks about the works done under the sun. He says there that all is vanity and grasping for the wind. And I've illustrated this in a number of ways, but this illustration is the easiest. And it's germane to the text. When you feel a wind buffeting, and of course we've seen that with regard to the hurricanes and such, and how much damage can be done. But the grasping for the wind, how vain it is, vain an effort to try to grasp something. It feels like there's substance to it. It's hitting you, after all, so why can't you grab it? But you can't. And that effort, that attempt to grab it is something that is useless. The idea, you see a child or a dog trying to bite or to grab hold of soap bubbles. They're there, you can see them, you reach for them and grab them, and there's nothing there. Nothing of substance. You can't hold on to it. That's the whole point. And so that idea is what we want to get out with regard to all of the things that are mentioned, especially in the first chapter. But you'll notice there on page 2 with regard to that list, it's something that goes throughout the book. Not only chapter 1, but 2, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8. There are examples that are given in that list that we want to go through. So the idea of vanity, those things that have no substance, no true worth, but again, and this is what you kind of want to keep in mind, there's a reason why people continually try them, because people think they're going to get something out of it. there's something that is appealing to making a lot of money. There's something that's appealing to some people with regard to being famous, or to have other people's respect, or to eat, drink, and be merry, to take advantage of all the sensual delights of the world. There is an allurement to all of these kinds of things that lead people to desire them, often to make them the focus of their lives, and yet ultimately it is a vain pursuit and leads to that despair and leads to that sigh. And we see examples of it. And that's the main thing that we want to point out with regard to learning from others' mistakes, because you see a lot of rich people that are just miserable. There are a lot of entertainers who have reached the pinnacle of fame and fortune that are miserable. Some have taken their lives. They live destructive lives because there's an emptiness there that they're trying to fill, and they're not successful no matter how big they might get or how famous they might get. And there are also those things that the more pedestrian among us seek to involve ourselves in. A lot of men and women who think that there's going to be some worth to life by working hard, by involving themselves in their work, and maybe by building something that they'll be remembered by, the creation of things. There are a lot of things that are mentioned in this where people are looking for something to fill the void, and it seems like it's going to happen for them, and they'll be happy once they get that, and they're not. Because that void it remains, because it's not filled by the one thing can truly fill it, which is God. So that's the premise that we want to make note of the book. I do want you to note at the bottom of the page, Thomas Wolfe, that quote. And again, I'm very much in agreement with his final sentence in that I am not given to dogmatic judgments in the matter of literary creation, but if I had to make one, I could say that Ecclesiastes is the greatest single piece of writing I have ever known, and the wisdom expressed therein the most lasting and profound. And it's at least something that is worthy of our study. It's, again, a favorite study of mine. All right, any questions, comments about that introductory material that there is there on page one? Anything you'd like to add to it? Okay, so let's just very quickly note something about the author. He identifies himself in verse 1 of the text as the preacher. There are three verses that you'll note in the first chapter. Verse 1, verse 12, I, the preacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem. I go back to verse 1, not only preacher, but the son of David, king of Jerusalem. And then in verse 16, where he says, look, I have attained greatness and have gained more wisdom than all who were before me in Jerusalem. My heart has understood great wisdom and knowledge. Now, if we were to look at that, those three things, and say, who, maybe put it on those 20 questions. And so these are the clues that you're given. Who is it that we're talking about? It's obvious that the individual is Solomon. There are people who disagree with that. They don't think that it was King Solomon that wrote the book. And I don't know the validity of those things. I've got a problem with individuals who would deny that Solomon wrote it for a couple of reasons, and I'll just note them real quickly and then we'll go on, because it's really not important. The Holy Spirit wrote the book, and we need to recognize that. But Solomon fits it, and the evidences that are claimed to say it was probably somebody other than Solomon are all external. It seems like the writing style, it seems like the first indication we have of the book, or the first evidence we have of the book, that all of that might indicate someone other than Solomon, someone of a later writing. That is typical of modernist scholarship. Typically what you'll find when individuals object to who is supposedly the writer of the book, it's they want to cast doubts upon the veracity of such claims. And what that serves to do, ultimately, is undermine our confidence in the integrity of the text. So it is the preconception of the modernist, whenever he enters into a study, that there's a good chance that what's being claimed is not actually so, and they try to accumulate evidence that would indicate otherwise. That's something that is destructive to faith. And there is no real reason other than that prejudice that exists to cast doubt upon what is presented at the forefront. You know, if it says I Paul, then Paul wrote it. If it says Peter, Peter wrote it. You know, you look through those things. Generally, you can trust that that's the case. But in this particular case, there are some who claim otherwise. But when you look at the text, it's obvious that the individual. And this is where I have a problem with those who say Solomon didn't write it, because the individual's wanting you to believe it's him. And so you think about this. How can we say that a text is inspired and trustworthy if the individual who wrote it wants you to think it was somebody else? So I've got a real problem with that kind of view, because the writer, he talks about him being the son of David, talks about him being a king, talks about him being having wisdom above all others. He wants you to think he's Solomon. And I think that it is. I think that he's identifying himself.
So is he considering himself to be a preacher as well?
In this context, he is. He's preaching right now. Mm-hmm. So that's the idea and I'd have to go back to the Hebrew. I didn't think to do that for this morning to find out what the actual Hebrew word is that is translated preacher in this particular text. But the reference is that I am instructing you in wisdom concerning the things of God. Anyone who does that's preaching. So in that sense, yes. Yes, Tracy.
I was reading one text that said that he never mentions himself as Solomon, his name, because he's ashamed of how he has lived his life. So he doesn't say his name Solomon.
Okay.
I don't know if that's any validity to that.
Possible. But he identifies himself clearly as right. At least the indications are that that's the case.
But not by name.
Well, there's nothing about this, because he's talking first person. These are things I've tried. And at the end of this vain life I've lived, this is the conclusion I've come to. So there's nothing to be proud of. Certainly, and I could see where there might be some reticence in his regard to naming himself completely. So whatever the reason is, it doesn't say Solomon in the text, but generally the old time conservative scholars, what's been believed for centuries is that Solomon wrote it, and then in the last 100 years or so there are men saying probably not, or maybe not, and you know. Again, you have to understand somewhat the bias is there. Yes.
I'm just looking at the Hebrew word. I can't pronounce it. It's Q-O-H-E-L-E-T-H. A word also meaning collector or convener.
Okay.
So, and some translate it teacher.
Okay.
But it's a collector.
So the one who collects knowledge. All right. Good. Thank you. All right. Okay. So keeping that in mind, let's get into a discussion of the text, and I do like the way he puts this. Now, I want you to note there are three major points that are found in this outline. The first one is the treatise on pessimism, where he goes through, and there are some things that are mentioned throughout the book that we want to acknowledge. Point number two is chasing the wind, which is basically again a reference to the first bullet point under 11 vanities that left him empty. That is the concept of human existence. Life is more than physical existence. So we're not going to spend a great deal of time in the bullet points talking about that one. And then human wisdom, which is the second bullet point under 1b, is actually talked about more in letter b of the second point. So we'll kind of go quickly over those two. And then when we get into those secondary points, we'll talk about them a little bit more. But the others, I do want to spend just a little bit of time talking about, because I think it's beneficial and helpful as we look at these different examples. So here we have that point of view, as we referred to, that device that he uses talking about vanity. That's the quandary that he has. He has lived his life. He is sad about the life that he has lived, because he has everything it is that the world has to offer. I mean, as a position, as a king, nothing is withheld from him. When you look at all of his material wealth, he was king during the pinnacle of Israel's existence with regard to wealth, obviously. When you look at his prestige, his power, his sexual proclivities that are mentioned as well with regard to the wives and concubines, all of the sensual things that life has to offer, those are things that he has experienced and tried, but he's dissatisfied. And that's where that idea of being vain or striving after the wind is given. Now, in letter B, there are 11 things that are mentioned in this particular text which show this to be so. And I would like to read the text of each of those. A couple of them are a little bit more lengthy, but others are short. And talk about them in turn. And again, points 1 and 2 we won't spend a great deal of time on. Would someone like to read for me verses 3 through 11 of chapter 1? Anybody who would like to do it? Yes, thank you, Laura. Appreciate it.
Okay, 3 through 11?
Yes, 3 through 11, chapter 1.
What profit has a man from all his labor in which he toils under the sun? One generation passes away and another generation comes, but the earth abides forever. The sun also rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it arose. The wind goes toward the south and turns around to the north. The wind whirls about continually and comes again on its circuit. All the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. To the place from which the rivers come, there they return again. All things are full of labor. Man cannot express it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. That which has been then is what will be. That which is done is what will be done. And there is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which it may be said, see, this is new? It has already been in ancient times before us. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of things that are to come by those who will come after.
Okay. So, bullet point one is human existence. And this is a good, though poetic, description of the way life is. And again, demonstrably true. Now, we understand that we've got technology these days. We live a little bit longer. But things are basically the way they've been since the world began. You've got the sun rises and sets. You've got the cycle of evaporation that continues. You've got the tragedies. You have the natural calamities. You've got the lot of all men to work and to toil every day. All of these kinds of things are things that people have been doing for millennia. And it's an interesting thing, just kind of an interest of mine at least, that with regard to technology. Technology has always been the claimed savior of mankind. It has happened since, I guess, probably every generation looks at the advances that have happened in their generation and thinks that, you know, life is so much better than what it was before. And there was a group that in the 19th century that were referred to as the Luddites. You may have heard of that phrase. It was a kind of political group over in England, I believe. And they were opposed to technology. They were saying that the steam engine is going to ruin life. and everybody else kind of made fun of them because, no, these are advances. And life is going to be so much better. Of course, what happened with the steam engine? You had pollution. All that kind of stuff happened. And the Industrial Revolution, there are certainly advantages from it, but there are disadvantages as well. And we can see that same thing today. And I remember when I was growing up, I liked to read Popular Science magazine from time to time and get a copy of it. And there was always these gee whiz, what's life going to be in the year 2017, you know, pictures. And the amazing thing is that all of the supposed inventions that would take place that would make life easier, to where basically nobody would have to work anymore, that your life would be a life of play because all of these changes would make work obsolete. All of those inventions and changes have either taken place or been surpassed. And yet look where we are. We're in the same condition where people are having to work. People are suffering economically. In fact, they say the division between the upper class and the lower class is widening and the middle class is disappearing and all of the haves and have-nots. You know, technology is not going to be the answer. So when we talk about the advances of men, and certainly it's neat that we have smartphones, and all of us are like this all the time, looking at them. It's not making life better; it's different, and we enjoy these things. They're distractions to us, but life is still life, and it always was, always is, and always will be the same in that regard. So a couple of things to note with regard to this: one is the cyclic nature of it. Again, you think about your lifetime. Everything comes and goes the same way. Sunrise, sunset, the next lifetime, same way. Next generation, same way. You'll notice that the statement in verse 8, all things are full of labor. The phrase full of labor, if you have a center reference or something, it's wearisome is the word that is used. So, yeah, I mean, we can see that as well. You go through it and you get tired. It's hard work to live, to be alive. That's not an easy thing. And then finally, in verse 2, people say, or verse 10, excuse me, is there anything of which it may say, see, this is new? Well, not really. You know, again, we talk about these new gadgets that come out and everything, but ultimately, we're talking about the existence of man and our experience, and you know, we've not stopped death, we've not stopped illness, we've not stopped pain and suffering. No matter what good is done, there's still man's inhumanity to man, and so the vanity of life continues. Everything is as it always has been, and it is as it always will be till the Lord comes again. And so that's not where value is to be found. So that's the basic idea or principle that's found in that section. Now, again, we'll talk more about that, the chasing of the wind, in point number 2 and letter A. Anybody want to add anything to that particular bullet?
Yes, you want? Look at all the themes like the Colosseum, you know, and the pyramids and all of the athletes, of the engineering.
Yeah, we're actually that. There's a little bit of an addition to that with regard to human labor in chapter 2, verses 19 through 21 that we're going to enlarge on. That's kind of where I put that, the accomplishments of men, the engineering things and such. But you're right about that too. And a couple of things to note about that as far as what men accomplish. Number one, we ask the question, okay, the Roman Colosseum, who built it? Who designed it? I mean, Romans, okay, yeah, but I'm talking about the individual who received no doubt glory. I mean, we when we talk about the accomplishments of men today, the architects and the individuals who are behind this, we praise them and they become famous for a time. But then, you know, then who knows in the future, who will know what? It's very limited in that regard, with regard to fame. So that, and secondly, they're decaying and going away. You know, it's nothing lasts forever. They're in ruins. And so as far as seeking to have value from some lasting monument to yourself, it's an interesting thing to go through graveyards, especially older ones. We had opportunity, forgetting out where it was located, but I think I went on a trip. It was in Germany, perhaps. It was an old Jewish graveyard. I've got pictures of it. I can't remember where it was. Wish I could. But we're talking about from centuries and centuries, and all the headstones were completely worn, where you couldn't read the writing at all. I mean, so you hear once while you see a little indention or something, but there had been something chiseled into stone to remember these people by. And now there is just a small graveyard with the headstones canted in different directions and falling over and such, and nothing to be able to derive from who it was or their existence. That's the way it is with regard to those things, and that's something to be mindful of as well.
And we're tearing all our monuments down now.
Yeah, that's
true. That's just more vanity.
Yeah.
Because you think that if you're etched in stone, you're going to last forever, but that's just not true.
Well, General Lee didn't, did he?
Just not. And Queen Hatshepsut, how do you say her name?
I don't know.
Well, they carved her name out, too, because they didn't like her being queen.
Yeah, so, yeah, that's... That's exactly right. But again, it was important. I mean, think about that. What are these pyramids for? They're tombs for the pharaohs or other important people, and yet every single one of them were robbed. I mean, King Tut was a very minor king, but his is the only one that wasn't robbed that they've found so far, which is why there was such a big great amount of booty that is found in that, or loot that's found there, because most of them were intricate efforts made to safeguard those things so that they will be remembered and their value will be seen, and it's all made. So we could, any number of examples, we could go ad infinitum with regard to examples of the vanity of that. The second vain thing, though, is wisdom, which is an interesting one because it's not one we consider typically to be a vain pursuit. Chapter 1, 13 through 18. Someone read that for me. Betty, would you?
And I set my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all that was done under heaven. This burdensome task God has given to the sons of man, by which they may be exercised. I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and indeed, all is vanity and grasping for the wind. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be numbered. I communed with my heart, saying, look, I have attained greatness, and have gained more wisdom than all who were before me in Jerusalem. My heart has understood great wisdom and knowledge, and I set my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceive that this also is grasping for the wind. For in much wisdom is much grief, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow.
Good, thank you. I just wanted to note verses 14 and 15, the tie-in, because he's talking there about works done. And in verse 15, what is crooked cannot be made straight, what is lacking cannot be numbered. And I think that within the greater context of this, the grief of wisdom, is the reality is that not no matter how much you know, some things can't be fixed. In other words, some people say, you know, if I knew enough, then that's I think a real fallacy again of many of our leaders of today and those who have their trust in technology and other things, is the idea that if we learn enough, if we gain enough knowledge, then we can solve the problems of the world. And there are certain things that the wise man came to understand are insolvable. You just cannot fix it. Crooked things that you cannot make straight, things that are insufficient that you cannot, by knowing, number them or gain or give them the value that is needed. That's something that's not possible. And so what is the end of wisdom? Then you'll notice at the end of the passage in verse 18, it's grief. And I have, in my lesson on this material, used the illustration between the joy of an ignorant child as contrasted with the sadness and world weariness of an individual who knows a lot. And I found that personally in my life. I spoke with an individual just recently about their domestic circumstances with their children, and that person told me that, you know, they had heard this saying, and you know, when the child is small, they'll step on your toes. When they become older, they'll step on your heart. And there's a lot of truth to that. As we've gotten older and as we've experienced life, whether it be with regard to mistakes others have made, whether it be with our own mistakes, but as wisdom is gained, the knowledge of the world, then there is a lot of weariness that comes as a result of that. But you get a small child, they're happy. You know, they didn't take much to keep them happy and make them smile. I was walking up into the pulpit Sunday night, and I glanced over at Emberly, which I have a tendency to do, I can't help it. And she was looking at me, and I glanced over, and she just grinned, big old grin, crinkling that nose, you know, like she always does when she grins, because she saw Pappy, and Pappy was looking at her, and that's all it took, you know, just that joy that was boom there. And I remember my trip to India. That was the thing that was so mindful, because in India, a third world country, there are a lot of suffering. And the interesting thing is the adults, for the most part, I wouldn't say grim, but they're aware of their lot and the difficulties of their life, and it wears them down a bit. And there's still joy there, and people smile at you and be gracious and such. But you see in the pictures and just in the set of the face in general with regard to the adults, there's an awareness of how difficult life is. But, you know, you've got a little kid playing in a filthy street near an open sewer with a cardboard box, and he's just as happy as he could be. You know, the joy of the children is the same everywhere in the world. And it's an interesting thing to see. So if we're thinking about the idea of wisdom as being the proper pursuit, it's not so. And I'm afraid that this is an area where maybe we get some... where we have some vulnerability as Christians. As a preacher, my emphasis, as you know, especially if you hear me preach quite often, is study the Word, know the Word, understand the Word. And I see in my own companions, fellow preachers, sometimes I think an emphasis based of gaining the knowledge that leads to speculation, that leads to arrogance, that leads to pridefulness, that leads to the idea that knowledge is the key. Well, that was what the Gnostics had fallen into in the second century. There were some indications that they in the first, but they were this so-called knowledge, this pursuit of knowledge as being the be-all and end-all. Now, we need to know God's will, so we need to study God's will, and obedience to God's will is key. But knowledge is the tool to obtain that. It's not the end-all with regard to the pursuit itself. And I'm afraid even, gospel preachers can get tied into that. I sometimes wonder some of the choices that are made as far as specializations of study, to where someone becomes an expert on something that is basically minutiae. They're an expert on it. They've learned all there is to learn about it. Maybe it's just something that interests them, but hopefully it's not something that they feel that is of any great importance, because the bigger message, the gospel, and those kinds of things is sometimes set aside for the pursuit of some intellectual achievement. So knowledge, wisdom, those kinds of things, a means to an end. The Bible talks about the importance of being wise, of gaining wisdom. But here the picture is wisdom as the be-all and end-all. That wisdom without respect to God. So what's important? The important thing is to learn. Now, understand this in the context, because he refers to himself in verse 16 as one who's obtained more wisdom than all who were before me in Jerusalem. He had wisdom. He had wisdom given to him providentially because he asked God for that wisdom and God granted it to him, in addition to the riches, because he asked for a good thing. And so wisdom is something that is desirable. But wisdom in itself isn't going to solve the problems of the world. Wisdom in its own pursuit is not inherently valuable. Now, where wisdom can be applied to spiritual standing with God, okay, now we're thumbs up in that regard. But that's not what he was doing. You know, and so that's where the vanity of it comes in. And do recognize verse 18, practically. The more you know, the more grief that you'll come across and be aware of, and the more personal grief it will cause you as a result of having that knowledge. That's just kind of the way in which it works. Wisdom is a function of knowledge plus experience. And the more you experience, the more sadness you're going to come across. And so that in itself is a vain pursuit as well. Yes?
I was thinking back to Adam and Eve in the garden when they took the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. And all of a sudden their eyes were open. And just like when we have a lot of knowledge and stuff, it opens your eyes to a lot of
the shame. That's one.
A lot of okay. things. Yeah. And I was also thinking about the child and stuff. The innocence of a child, they just say, oh, well, let's just feed everybody. Let's just take care of everybody in the world. You know, this is doable. Let's do it. And as an adult, you realize the insurmountable task that's before you to feed everybody in the world, to make everybody on an equal field. It's definitely just not.
Yeah, as a preacher, I have that same thing. When a young preacher is idealistic and very naive, thinks that simply because I say something that has the foundation of God's Word and has the force and authority of that Word, that that's going to affect change in the lives of everyone that I speak to. And as you get older, you learn that's not the case. So, yeah, experience is a very harsh but able teacher to us. Yes, Tracy?
I also thought about the rich young ruler when he came to the knowledge of what he had to do, but he didn't have the wisdom to carry it out, and he went away sorrowful. Or the unbeliever, or the believer who becomes an unbeliever, and then what they give up.
Good point. Good point. All those are good examples. Anybody else? All right, then, the third point in this that we're going to spend a little bit more time on, well, I say a little more time, we probably, about the same amount of time, because we spent more time on those first two than I intended. Human pleasure. chapter 2, verses 1 through 11. Who would like to read that final lengthy reading? Pat, thank you.
I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with mirth, therefore enjoy pleasure. But surely this is also vanity. A set of laughter, madness, of mirth, what does it accomplish? I searched in my heart how to gratify my flesh with wine while guiding my heart with wisdom. How to lay hold on folly till I might see what was good for the sons of men to do under heaven all the days of their lives. I made my works great. I built myself houses, planted myself vineyards. I made myself gardens and orchards. I planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made myself water pools from which to water the growing trees of the grove. I acquired male and female servants, had servants born in my house. Yes, I had greater possessions of herds and flocks than all who were in Jerusalem before me. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the special treasures of kings of the providence, of the provinces. I acquired male and female singers, the delights of the sons of men, musical instruments of all kinds. So I became great and excelled more than all who were before me in Jerusalem, while my wisdom remained with me. Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure, for my heart rejoiced in all my labor, and this was my reward from my labor. Then I looked on all the works that my hands had done, and on the labor in which I had toiled. And indeed, all was vanity and grasping for the wind. There was no profit under the sun.
Okay, thank you. There's a lot of good stuff to find in this. I want you to notice the latter part of verse 10. He says, this is my reward from all my labor. None of these things that he's referring to here were taken illegitimately. So we can acknowledge, first of all, that, and by the way, again, God does not say that we should not appreciate and enjoy the things that we can. There's nothing wrong with attaining a possession, for example, of engaging in some form of recreation. That's not the point, of course. The idea is the vanity of these pursuits in and of themselves without respect to God. So, you know, he does make this point in verse 10 that I am getting what is the reward for the work that I did. He was the king. He was in this position. He had this this opportunity to do these things, and he did not withhold anything from himself. He didn't get them through, they were not ill-gotten gains. In other words, he didn't rob anyone. You know, his taxation was pretty oppressive, but that was his right as the king. So these were not gained because of sinful practices, let's put it that way. Because something can be inherently wrong if you get something that doesn't belong to you, if you've coveted, but these are things he said, this is my lot, I'm the king, I have the right to have these things, and I've tried them all. But the point is that it's vain. So whatever was lacking inside his heart was not filled by these things either. Looking at the specifics, there are two things that I think are kind of contained in this. The first one, when we're talking about the pursuit of pleasure, is of laughter. And I like that phrase in verse 2. I said of laughter, madness, and of mirth, what does it accomplish? If you want to prove the veracity of that, I would invite you to watch a video that my daughter Kendra recorded last week. This was, well, a week and a half ago. This was before Debbie's surgery. Jeremiah got to our house Sunday night late, and we were all waiting up to see him before we went to bed. And as he walks in the front door, a bird flies in right over the top of his head, swoops right over the top of his head into our house. And so the next 5 minutes were taken up in getting butterfly nets, dodging swooping birds, and getting that bird outside, with Debbie screaming at the top of her lungs every time the bird took off, coming at her most of the time. It was a funny thing. So, but what I want you to do, if you want to doubt it, is to watch that video with no sound. In other words, it was crazy. But you know, when you think about that, someone who's laughing, if you didn't understand the the reason for the laughter. Or if you're finding someone who's actually, you know, their button's been pushed and they can't help themselves and they're just bowling over with laughter and they can't stop. There's something a little bit crazy about that. Something a little bit insane about that kind of behavior. And that's kind of what he's referred to there in verse 2. It's madness. It's really, you get a little bit unhinged with regard to those kinds of things. Now, it feels good, and we enjoy laughing, and there's nothing wrong with laughing. But there are people, again, who strive to do that, make that the center part of their life. And the interesting thing about it, I'll just give you two examples. There's a story, it may be apocryphal, about a man who went to a psychiatrist, and he wanted some joy in his life. He was miserable, depressed, and despairing. And the psychiatrist suggested that the great clown, I think it's Panini or something like that, or I forget what his name was, is in town. Go and watch him, and you'll receive joy. And he said, "But I am Panini." He's referring, he himself was the clown. And then the modern counterpoint to that is Robin Williams, who committed suicide, who was supposedly the funniest guy who's ever lived, just about. A lot of people felt that way. He was a sad clown. He tried, there was something missing in his life, and he tried to fill that with laughter and mirth and glee, and it never did satisfy him. It made a lot of other people happy, but it sure didn't satisfy him. It was sad. So, you know, again, that kind of thing. What's life about? Just go enjoy it. Enjoy all that you can in life. That's not really the answer, whether it be with regard to laughter or the idea of enjoying pleasure. In verse 1 of the text, enjoy pleasure. So the things that you can put together, you can obtain, you can come across, this says, okay, this is going to be enjoyable. This is what life's all about. And boy, looking at what he's gotten, houses he built, the vineyards, the gardens, the water pools, the servants, possessions, silver, gold, special treasures of kings, male and female singers. Remember the court jester? The purpose of the court jester was to make the king happy. And he better be good at it, because his head might be cut off if the king doesn't like what he said. But I remember the bad, dark, murderous moods of Saul as an example of king. And I mean, he had everything he needed, everything he could want, except one who was under him was gaining more praise than he was, and he was unhappy as a result of it. So that's the kind of thing that we indicate from this text is vain. All right, so we recognize it and understand it, but this pursuit of pleasure is what our society is about today. It really is. Either the pursuit of pleasure or the pursuit of possessions, which is involved in that. That's what is most important in the United States of America in our culture. And with the demonstration of that latest, iPhone 10. Who wants an iPhone 10? Nobody? Oh, come on. Some of y'all have iPhones. Who has iPhones right now?
I
you don't want the 10 now?
No.
Okay. All right. I don't want it either, but I'd like to have a Note 8.
I don't either.
Okay. So, Samsung Note 8, if anybody doesn't know what that is.
Stan, I was going to say that on the news broadcast this morning, they were asking if the i10 was worth it and stuff. And the answer was yes, if your company pays for it.
Yeah.
And I thought, okay, so that just tells you it's not really worth it.
Yeah. It's $1,000 for a new phone. That is starting at $1,000, iPhone 10. Yeah, but yeah, kind of peculiar, but that's a lot of people like it. But that's the kind of thing we're talking about. There's no real ultimate value in those things. Okay, got time for one more. Let's go to chapter 2, verses 19 through 21. Who wants to read that one? Chapter 2, 19 through 21. Mom, would you do that for me? Chapter 2, 19 through 21.
And who knows whether he will be wise or a fool, yet he will rule over all my labor in which I toiled and which I have shown myself wise under the sun. This also is vanity. Therefore I turn my heart and despair of all the labor in which I have toiled under the sun. For there is a man whose labor is with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, yet he must leave his heritage to a man who has not labored for it. This is also vanity and a great evil.
Okay, thank you. In fact, he probably should have started verse 18. You know, we had the human wisdom kind of ending that, but I hated all the labor which I told under the sun. Who knows whether the one who comes after me will be a wise or a fool? So now we're talking about then the things that you do, your work. Understand there's nothing wrong with work ethic. In fact, we should have a work ethic. Man who does not care for his own, especially those of his own household, is one who's condemned by God. Worse than an infidel. So work is important. But I want you to just think, because it may be that some of you here, I have to admit, I'm 55, and my generation did not have the same work ethic than the generation that preceded mine. And there's some good to that. Not a lot of good to it. They're talking about the millennial generation, you know, this latest one that's reached adulthood, and how the work ethic is very lacking in that generation. So we're being stereotypical to a certain extent. But what about the generation that preceded mine, and maybe in times past, probably possibly coming from an agrarian background, farming, having to work from sunrise to sunset, the value that was placed upon work and the work ethic. I think that often that was destructive, because men, just to give you an example with regard to the raising of children, where men were fathers, but they weren't dads. In other words, they maybe were disciplinarians, which is good, but there was not a relationship with their children because they were too busy working. They thought work was what their relationship to their children should be. I work hard, I provide for them, I'm the provider. And if not anything else, I think it's certainly destructive to the child's welfare, but it certainly is an indication of missing out on some wonderful relationships that one could have had with their kids. So there's just one example that kind of comes to my mind in this regard. And what are the men doing? So women can have the same work ethic, so we're not trying to be sexist in this regard. But thinking about the patrician society that we were part of, patriarchal society and such, you have men that basically say, what my purpose is to give my children that which I didn't have. So I'm going to work hard, I'm going to spend my life putting this this wealth together, and when I die, not having utilized it myself or enjoyed it myself, I will have left something for my children. And then the children come along and they blow it or they spend it in ways that would have caused the father's hair to turn gray even quicker. You know, that kind of thing is present, and that's kind of what he's talking about here. What have you really accomplished if you work hard all of your life? You gain a lot of wealth as a result of working so hard. You've not enjoyed it yourself. And when you give it to the person who comes after you, what's he going to do with it? He may just dissolutely get rid of it. You know, just spend it in ways. And you know, you hear about the lottery. Is that lottery is often destructive to the people who win it. You know, because disproportionately the people who seek to get rich through the lottery are poor people. Never handled money. They get the money and it ruins their life. You know, it's just because they're foolish with regard to their handling of it. And so the idea of working to gain something is something that in and of itself is vain. So again, one of those things where we have to keep in the proper context, because we are to work, making provision for our family, we could be inclusive of, in our day and time, insurance and retirement and those kinds of things, and inheritance. All of those things are good things, but it's not the reason you're on earth. How many times have you seen men who said, you know, I've got a business to build, but I don't have time to go to church, or I don't have time for my kids or my family. And they get, I tell you, as a preacher, every single funeral I've ever preached, there's never been anything. It may have been noted that a person was a successful businessman and made a lot of money, but it's never said that was what was important. It's always faith and family. Well, not always faith and family. Sometimes it's just family, because sometimes they never had any faith. And that's the sad thing. And I've a couple of funerals that I've preached where that's basically what it was. The family, no one's Christians because the father wasn't there. Maybe the widow's Christian. She's the only one. The family's not. Kids aren't. Grandkids aren't. The husband wasn't because he was too busy working. And yeah, they're comfortable, but they don't have a hope of heaven. And he doesn't have hope of heaven because he never served the Lord. And so that idea of human labor as being valuable is something that is full of vanity as well. All right? Question, comments before we end the class? Yes?
Sorry, I know I'm talking a lot.
No. I want the discussion, so that's good. Thank you.
And yet there's still that balance. Because Paul tells us in Thessalonians to not grow weary in our labor because we have to provide for our family. So there is that balance with our labor.
Yeah, and all of this, it has to be keeping the point of view in mind, the quandary that he had. This is what I thought life was about, and I found that it's not. And, I mean, some of these things aren't legitimate, I suppose, but the majority of them are things that we legitimately see value in, but not value in without respect to God being in the picture.
It's not what we live for. We live for Christ. The other is second, or third.
And again, it's just that's the question we want to ask ourselves. That's the question that I suppose one of the primary purposes of preachers in sharing various messages from God's Word is to say, you know, are you asking yourself the question, is this important? And how much importance should we place on it? Because it's a sense of values and priorities. And if God's not first, then we're missing out on everything of any value. Why shall a man profit if he gains the whole world? Loses his own soul. It's just not worth it. So we'll talk a little bit more. Perhaps we'll go a little bit faster with the remainder bullet points before we get into the next section. I do want to spend a little time going over his thoughts with regard to human existence and human wisdom. So I have a feeling what we'll do is get through that and possibly have opportunity to get into the discussion questions. But I think it's probably going to take maybe one full and part of another to get through it all into the second. Since we're, you know, we don't have to do one a week in this regard. We can go at any speed we want. But if we're going too slow, you want to go faster, let me know. If we get a consensus of that, or if we're going too fast, you want to go slower, let me know. We'll just take it whatever speed you want. People will say, it's always my fault, but then I go away and the next guy comes in and teaches for a week. They don't get any farther than I do. So I think it's a class, not the teacher.
And y'all blame women.
Yeah. No, I'm not going to do that. If Justin Carroll and Dick Hatch and a couple of others were in this class, we wouldn't have got through the first point, I don't think. So, all right. Appreciate very much everyone's attention today and attendance. And hope y'all can keep doing this every single week. And we'll pick up with bullet number 5 next week.